Take it from me, you guys are not going to want to miss the party of the summer. It's Rocklahoma, it's back in Pryor, Labor Day weekend, September 1st through 3rd, and it's going to feature acts like Warrant, LA Guns, Bullet Boys, Godsmack, Chevelle, Daughtry, Skid Row, Limp Bizkit, Bush, Theory of a Dead Man, Asking Alexandria, Kix, Pantera, Rob Zombie, Corey Taylor, and many, many more. Go to rocklahoma.com right now to get your weekend passes and keep listening to On the Road to Rock with me, Clint Switzer, to learn how you can win two weekend passes for the whole weekend of Rocklahoma. Stay tuned.
What's up, everybody? It's John Bush from Armored Saints sitting here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You are on the road to rock.
Hi, everyone. This is Eric Martin, the lead singer for the band Mr. Big, and you are on the road to rock with Clint Switzer.
Thank you so much, man. I love talking about the things that I love, Clint, and for you to allow me to do it with you. God bless you. God bless the Heartland. God bless America.
You are now on the road to rock. It's not just a podcast. It's an unabashed celebration of rock's living legends. And now, please welcome your host, the master of your rock and roll road trip, leading you down the highway to hell, Clint Switzer.
The Summer of Rock continues here on the Road to Rock. I'm your host, Clint Switzer, and we are celebrating the official kickoff to summer this week with another tremendous guest. Joining me on this show is going to be rap bassist Juan Crucier. He's going to be talking about the latest Rat box set, the Atlantic Years, 1984 to 1991, a new limited edition box set from BMG in partnership with Rhino Entertainment, celebrating Rat's massively successful period where all five of their studio albums were certified gold, platinum, or multi-platinum. You've got the LP set, the CD set, which features all five of the studio albums in a side-loading box. You've got 11x17 Rat Wanted poster, bumper sticker, replica backstage pass, and guitar pick in a custom lift top box. This box set celebrates Rat in its first incarnation, the Rat we all know and love. Of course, we had Stephen Piercy on this show back in February talking about all things, his solo efforts that he's doing right now. He's out on a solo Sunset Strip experience tour. We're going to ask Juan, is there a chance? What's this look like? Is there going to be a chance that Rat ever plays together again? Stephen Piercy's been very forthright in thinking that that's probably not going to be the case unless they can get all the original members to do a new album together. We know Warren doesn't really want a tour, so that looks very unlikely. A lot of drama with Bobby. It's always been the case with Rat. It's always been controlled chaos. But what we're doing on this interview with Juan is celebrating those first five albums from Atlantic Records, starting with Out of the Cellar, which exploded Rat onto the scene. They were so massively popular at that time. Bands like Poison and Bon Jovi were opening for Rat during that period. And talking to Juan about just like the trajectory for Rat after that, they didn't release like the top end ballad that went nuts, that launched so many other bands like Motley Crue, Poison, and a million others into up the charts. They didn't have that. They had this sort of sneering front man and the guitar hero in Warren Demartini, the drummer, in Bobby Blotzer, and Juan, who was like an over-the-top, showman of a bassist, but very, very like funky groove type, sort of a jazz-inspired bassist. We're going to talk to him about all that, the videos for like Out of the Cellar, Wanted Man, some of those early videos, the memories behind him. It is the Summer of Rat here because Rat's always been like a summertime band for me. It's a feel-good, good time. Those guitar riffs, as soon as you hear Warren Demartini's guitar, to me, that is summertime personified. And we're going to get into all that and much more with Juan. So thanks for being on the part of the show. It's been a tremendous summer so far. Some of the guests we've had on from Dee Snider. Coming up, we've got Klaus Eichsted from Ugly Kid Joe. Kelsey Carter from Kelsey Carter and the Heroines. Those are coming up. And here, Juan Crucier. It's been several years. I think it's been since around 2019 since Juan's been on the show. So this is going to be great to have him back on to talk about this box set, what he's been up to in the meantime since Rat has not been touring or a functioning band. And so we're going to give you all that update coming up here. But before we do, got to remind you that Rocklahoma is coming to Pryor. It is Labor Day weekend. It is the party of the summer, America's preeminent rock fest. It's going to be bands like Bush, Limp Bizkit, Rob Zombie, Pantera, Corey Taylor, Wolfgang Van Halen, Skid Row, Kix, Warrant, Bullet Boys, much more. And you know you can win tickets. You know you can go to our Facebook page, On the Road to Rock, on Facebook, and enter the contest. It's pinned to the top of our page, so just enter the contest, and you can win two passes to Rocklahoma. If you don't want to wait all that time, you want to go get your tickets now, go to rocklahoma.com, secure your weekend passes to the party of the summer, and we can't wait to see you there. It is so great to have the incomparable Juan Crucier back on the Road to Rock. Actually, it's been so long, Juan, since we had you on that the name of the show changed. So welcome to On the Road to Rock for the first time. How are you, sir?
That's what it is. Okay. All right. Well, great to be back. Awesome.
Well, it's great to have you. You look wonderful. What's life been like? What have you been up to lately, man? It's been a couple years. What's been on the agenda for you, my friend?
You know, I've been working a lot on music and had a lot of things I've been doing in the studio, staying busy. You know, got the family going on and the kids are growing quick and, you know, it just, everything's great.
How many kids do you have?
I have four.
Oh my gosh. I didn't realize you that. That's yeah. Wow. What's the, like, yeah. How old's like the youngest one?
Well, the youngest one's nine.
You oh know, my and gosh.
Then, oh yeah. Yeah. And then my oldest one is 30. Geez, he's 34. So, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch there, but so, you know, been doing great with the family and enjoying the passage of time.
Well, great. It's great to see. And you've kind of been out there making the rounds a little bit since, you know, the release of this fantastic new box set. It's the Atlantic Years Rat 1984 to 1991 limited edition box set from BMG in partnership with Rhino Entertainment, celebrating Rat's massively successful period. 1984 to 91. One, when I look at this and you think about this box set, you think about that 5-album run from Rat, I think I would put it up against any band from the era. And I'd never really thought about it that much or compared it or like, oh, how does that compare against Motley Crue? But with this box set coming out, I've really looked into it. And I'm like, I don't know that there is a band that can match these great albums. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, there was a certain chemistry on these five records, and the first three records really kind of sort of set the tone. You know, actually the EP set the tone, but what came after the EP were these records. And you know, we were just very fortunate to be able to have this period of time. A lot of things went into it, a lot of things go into a band being successful, right? You know, so we had the right record company, you know, the right timing and, you know, right production. So a lot of things really kind of sort of the confluence of events that occurred brought forth this unique group of records that have, you know, withstood the test of time.
Absolutely the case. And I don't know if you ever heard it's been a year or two ago now, I think. I don't know if you know Chris Jericho, who's the singer from Fozzy, but he does a podcast. He's a wrestler, and he did a classic album battle. It was Rat Out of the Cellar versus Invasion of Your Privacy. And the tone of that was that, like, oh, well, you know, Rat, these two albums are iconic, but it was kind of diminishing returns after that. And I like vehemently disagree. I think Detonator is right up there with some of the best albums you guys did. And that was at the tail end when things were spiraling out of control. So I don't agree that there were diminishing returns in these albums. I love Dancing Undercover as much as I do Out of the Cellar, and same for Detonator, honestly. So that's, it's a narrative that I don't agree with, because I think that the qualities remained. Would you agree with on that front?
Yeah. You know, look, you know, anytime you got a group, it's a compromise.
Sure.
And as the band evolves, you know, there was a big difference from the time that we were playing locally in Hollywood and throughout the greater Los Angeles area as compared to the, you know, when we'd be on a tour for 10 or 11, 12 months, you know, the demands on the group itself changed quite a bit. Music changed, trends changed. There's so many factors that went into it. that it's very, very difficult to, and to say nothing of personal things, you know, people going through changes and the things that happen in life. So you always strive to make the best record you can under the conditions that you're under at the time. So, you know, to say diminishing returns, you know, I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion, certainly, you know, but, you know, we tried to evolve is the thing.
Sure. And do you feel like with the release of this box set that it's kind of put you back into that world a little bit, like maybe revisiting some of the songs, some of the albums, or just the, you know, reflecting more on that time period in your life? Or is it just kind of been like, oh, hey, this is a great release that has come out to celebrate that period and haven't really thought much more about it? What's been your kind of emotional attachment to this box set?
You know, it's a milestone of sorts, you know. It certainly encapsulates a magical period of time for Rat. Probably it's sweetest years, if you will, you know, where things kind of came together. It has a great sound to it. I listened to the tracks as they were being remastered for vinyl. And one of the things that I find unique is that I know vinyl's making a comeback, and that's wonderful. It's a great thing. The reason it's making a comeback, among many reasons, is because the sound of vinyl is unique unto itself. Nothing else quite sounds like it. Not tape, not cassette tape, certainly not CDs.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a gentleman named Andy Pierce remastered these records, and he did a great job. He basically, in layman's terms, he brought out the guitars more and made them more prominent. Now you put that kind of sonic signature onto vinyl, which brings out low end and sort of this sort of elegant, you know, sonic quality to it. And that makes for a unique and interesting take on five records that were, you know, a great time for the band's career. So, you know, there's been different things that have been released over the years. And what makes this one unique is that you get the five records, you get a unique tour booklet that's what I call it. But it's basically it's a history of pictures. And all the guys from the group that are still with us here went into their archives and sort of, you know, pulled out old pictures. I went into, you know, some old boxes and started looking at things. And I literally spent days just looking, walking down memory road, you know, and found stuff from the early club days all the way until, the later years of the band. So it's really unique in the sense that it's a group of things here that there's been nothing like it that we've ever done before. So for the Rat fan out there, if there was one thing that you really wanted to sort of, you know, prioritize having, this would certainly be it, because the records are going to sound different. They're going to get, you're going to hear things you sort of didn't hear before. And it has other things in it that you've never seen before. So it's an interesting insight into the group.
Oh, yeah. There's an 11 by 17 wanted poster, bumper sticker, replica backstage pass. Those won't work these days if you want to see Juan or go out to see Stephen Piercy. You're not able to use the backstage pass, but it will be a very memorable thing to have in your collection. That is amazing. And of course, all five studio albums. Juan, when it comes to bass, you know, I'm not a musician. I'm a simple person. So when I grow up listening to this music and I discover bands like Motley Crue and Poison or Dokken or Rat, Quiet Riot, most of those bands you've been in at one point in time, know, I didn't think about the bass and what the bass is and what that instrument is. It wasn't maybe until I got deeper into Rat and I started hearing a song like Lay It Down or I'm Insane, and to really understand the intricacy of what you were doing on those albums. And it's like something I totally appreciate now as an adult, that I think that bass playing and added so much to it. And that's a tough thing to do when you've got a guitar hero like Warren DeMartini in the band, but your bass playing, especially, you know, early on, really stood out. What was the balance like in the studio trying to get, like, we got to get these guitars, we got to get these drums, and the bass somehow was able to shine out, whereas some bands it doesn't.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different approaches that you can take with songs, and thank you. That's a very nice to hear that. Look, when you're in the studio, you sort of have to look at the big picture, depending on what the role of the instrument is, and it's sort of a team effort. Mm-hmm. So I deliberately left a lot of space for the guitars to shine above, and didn't want to interfere with what the guitar players were attempting to do. I wanted to lay down a really solid foundation and bridge the gap between the drums and the rhythm guitars. So a lot of times I would refrain from overplaying just to give that space to the guitars and even the drums in many times, you know. So, you know, it's a type of thing where, you know, I'm a singer-songwriter, so I understand the different roles of the instruments and how the inner workings together, they're intertwined. And, you know, anytime you have something that you want to feature, you have to set up the background for it to be featured. So I really tried to play with discipline and play for the song itself, what the song needed.
That's a great answer. And that's kind of helps me, you know, as a non-musician to relate to that. And I think that's really important. And I mean, something like loving Use a Dirty Job, when it kicks in, it's a subconscious thing. The bass to me has always been kind of subconscious, unless it's like a Lemmy riff, or like, you know, the beginning, the intro to Dr. Feelgood, or that part in Lay It Down that boom, boom, boom. I mean, you know, it's there. But to be able to understand those intricacies in someone like you, I think you were as good as there was when you look back on it, that did the instrument in the 80s, my friend. That's the truth. So I think that you get a lot of praise now, maybe that you were maybe overlooked or in the 80s, maybe because you had to be the guy on stage moving around all the time.
Well, you know, it's funny because I come from sort of a jazz fusion progressive background. And so when I was a young musician, we sort of judged each other by like, how intricate a song can you play, you know?
Yeah. And,
you know, so, but then over the years, I started realizing that a lot of these songs were tailored for the type of band that required that kind of playing. For example, a band like Yes was designed for the bass to carry a lot more movement, you know, along with many others. You know, you have
Rush.
Rush. Yes, absolutely. And scores of others, you know. So in sort of finding that right discipline to add what is needed, it requires a lot to sort of not play, you know, when you want to throw a riff in. It's kind of cool to throw that riff in, you know, but does it make the song sound better? And so I really tried to make it as solid and as reliable as I could, and make it easy for everybody else. Another interesting thing is I'm a finger player. I play with my fingers.
Yep.
And on all these, on these five records, I play with a pick. So it's a different feel and it's a different sound. But when you play with a pick in rock, that you can place the bass in a different spot because it has a little more attack and a little more clarity, if you will, where the finger is a little more old school and it's a different feel. So I just really tried to sort of tailor the bass to the band's needs and create an overall sonic picture that was sort of our fingerprint, if you will.
What were some memories of doing some of the early videos? I mean, Round and Round, of course, is iconic, but to me, the first video I remember seeing as a kid was Wanted Man, and just like the fact that you had this like Wild West shootout going on. I love immersive videos, and people like look back on that today as, you know, Dokken did a lot of videos like that too. Burning Like a Flame, they're in fireman outfits. They did a video on a volcano. Like, that's just what it was in the 80s. MTV had just come out when Out of the Cellar came out. So like, talk about some of the early memories of doing those videos, because like they just live on in this iconic realm today.
Well, let me tell you something you may not often hear. When we would do these videos, I learned really, really quickly that they were going to be really difficult to make. They were going to be very demanding. A lot of it is what you would typically sort of think, but some of it was, you know, something you may not have anticipated, and that was hurry up and wait. All right. So typically when these videos started happening for groups, there was a new, you know, MTV and various other smaller video channels were starting to spring up. Mm-hmm. And so bands were starting to make videos for these outlets, and you had to cram a lot into a little bit of time. So the hours were extremely long. They were very demanding. I remember when we did the Lay It Down video, it was the next morning. It was daylight outside, and we were inside this movie studio, you know, taping the final live performance. You know, when, you know, I mean, we've been at it for maybe, you know, well over 24 hours, and everybody was just like, you know, at this point, you know, sleep deprived. And you had to go out there and, like an athlete, give it your all to capture everything that the director needed.
Sure.
So the expense of these videos were such that you really couldn't do it over several days. Many times you had to sort of compartmentalize and compress everything together. So one thing about videos that I always felt kind of going in was, wow, this is going to be a long day. Here comes another one, you know.
Yeah, like at a live performance, you get that immediate interaction from the fans. You're just in it. It's the energy. You're on stage an hour and a half, and it's just then people always talk about how different it is when you're making a movie, making a commercial, making a video. It's just like this. You don't get that immediate gratification, that reward. It's like, oh, but you see the finished product. You're like, that's why we did all that. That was awesome.
No, you know, and you're totally right. And the one thing about playing live is that you know, everything's geared around the live show that day and night. So you go out there and you play for an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes, whatever the case may be. And you know that you're done for the night. When you're shooting a video, you go out there and you shoot a certain scene, then you do a certain live scene, and you're pretty much getting like to the point where you're going, okay, man, I'm glad we're done. And all of a sudden the director goes, wait, we're not done yet. Hang out for another 5 hours, and then we're going to have you do another live performance. So, you know, you just sort of have to adapt. But it was a unique sort of skill set of pacing yourself while trying to deliver your maximum, you know. Mm. So, you know, and again, you know, they're all different in their own ways. And some of them were a blast, like Wanted Man, you know. That was a lot of fun to shoot, you know, only because it was like, you know, shot in a little Western town, and we got to ride some horses and
kind of shoot have a some guns. And I don't think they'd let that fly today in a video, firing guns around.
Probably
that's
not.
Why I prefer the 80s, though. You could do anything you wanted.
That's right. Yeah. Well, almost anything. Yeah.
I got to ask you, because to this day, and I just watched this movie last week. I watch it every summer, which is Point Break. Nobody Writes For Free has been a top five Rat song for me for really since the song came out in 91 as a single.
Right.
The thing about that is that was like the literal end of the band. Just that video was about the last we would see from Rat for some time in that incarnation. Just kind of talk about that song, how it came about, and the fact that things ended the way they did so quickly. And that, like, I just always like to imagine what things would have been like had you been able to build off that song into a new album after that. Hey, that's a what if in rock and roll history. But
that song was definitely a bookmark of sorts. Yeah. The history of it was unique. Our management company at the time told us, hey, there's an opportunity to record this song that I'll try to just stick to the main points. It's kind of a long story.
Sure.
So we were told basically that we could, you know, work on this song, change it any way we could or needed to, that we would get writing credit and everything would be copacetic. And so, you know, we went ahead and made some very, very significant changes to the song. And originally, it was sort of a drony keyboard demo.
Hmm.
And not to take away from the original writer, all due respect, you know, music is art, and whatever way art comes out in whatever fashion, it's all good, right? It's art, you know. But we're a hard rock band.
Yeah.
You know, with no keyboards, you know, so we had to sort of interpret that, and we needed a bigger hook, and we needed a pre-chorus and a tag, of which I wrote. And Warren added some things, obviously uniquely his as a guitar player. And so we changed the lyrics, melodies, and so forth. So there was a significant change. And, you know, it was the last thing that we recorded. And the interesting thing about it is that when we did it, Warren did all the guitars. At that point, Robin was no longer with us. Right. And I did all the backgrounds alone by myself. So that took a little bit of, I just layered them, you know. And so it brought a unique snapshot of the band in a way that was never seen before. And I totally agree with you. By the way, Mick Kozowski was the engineer producer, and mm-hmm. he was a mixing engineer. He'd remix other people, other songs to make them hit singles. But I totally agree with you that it was a unique song that, you know, was sort of a look at what could have been beyond that, you know, a snapshot of what could have come.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it was a very condensed version of Rat because it was just the four of us at the time. Mick really didn't have anything to do with the pre-production of the song. We demoed it at my studio and that the demo came out great. And then once we got Mick involved, then we had, we of course went to another studio to do a full band recording and the version that you hear today.
It's iconic to me. I love that song. And I think that, like, I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but to me, music is so immersive, and I like, you know, it puts me in a time and a place or a mood or whatever. Rat, yes, to me, is the ultimate summertime band. When I hear Warren's guitar, when I hear Steven's voice, it is summertime. And I don't know, was that ever like something that was conscious, or I don't know if it's just me being the way I am, and I'm a weird seasonal person. In Missouri, we do get all the four seasons. So I'm like, hey, in the fall, I love football and pumpkins and Halloween. So I don't know. Was there anything to that? Have you ever heard anyone say that before?
You know, I'll tell you, Rat was always a good time band.
Right.
You know, and that's, we didn't really get into any really, really heavy subjects or anything to do with, for example, politics or, you know, some type of, stance. We just wanted to have the people have a great time with us, party, celebrate their lives, sort of give them a break from the trials and tribulations that life can sort of, throw at us. So to say that we're a good times sort of summer band, that's a great look at it. You know, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with you.
Yeah. And just the LA, the Sunset Strip, all those images that, like, in my head as a youngster that I'd never been to LA. I didn't, all I knew was like what I'd see in movies. And like, I see these evocative images and I watched like the movie Point Break and the Rat song's in there and the Rat video looks like the movie Point Break. And I'm just like, yeah, all this stuff and this, the beaches, and it all just sort of like clicked together for me. And I think Rat embodied that. And it does to this day. Every time I play in Rat, like my girlfriend's a huge fan too. And I'm just like, it's summertime. We're blasting Rat down to the lake or whatever. Like it just hits, you know? You rejoined the band, of course, in 2012. You guys had moments. 2016, had a very successful tour. Tried it again in 2018. We've had Steven on this show not long ago. Obviously, not trying to like dig up any, you know, hey, give me some breaking news. Are you guys ever, but what's kind of just the status for you? Like, would you ever want to try again? I mean, Steven said, hey, I'd do it if we get the original members together. You're one of those members, one. So I guess we got to ask you.
You know, I appreciate that, Clint, you know, and look, Rat has had a very long history, hasn't it?
Yes.
You know, and at this point, there are certain things that I just don't want to get into. And yeah, it's no other reason than it would be inappropriate when I'm trying to just kind of like let people know about this awesome box set.
Yes, sure.
You know, I just think that, you know, we need to sort of, just kind of like leave. Well, let me just stop.
How's that? I that's what I expected, Juan. I had to ask it in some way. Just like, you know what I mean? And, because, we have spoken to other, Steven has been on this show and he's kind of always been open about what he feels. And he goes out and does his thing. You're doing music. I think that's great. And like, you're right. Celebrating the legacy is important. And I think Rat's legacy is amongst the best from what, in my opinion, is one of the most important time periods in rock history, which is that 80s part. In fact, actually, we have a question from our Facebook page. That's from our friend Shaggy Shane Williams, and he has a question for you. And I think I know the answer to this because just you were in both Rat and Dokken for like 18 months. So I'm assuming that the timing was the answer to this. But he asked, when did you know that you needed to leave Dokken for Rat and why?
Well, that's a great question. And listen, you know, all good. Okay. So, there's certain things I like focusing on, you know, with intention. And I think that the band's legacy, the group, I wanted to say one last thing here. The group that recorded these five records was a very good band. I would never denigrate that or take anything away from that band.
Sure.
The thing is, in life, things change, things evolve. And so I like to just keep the focus on the positive stuff. I don't like to speculate about anything. So in answer to your question, having said that, it was a really difficult decision because I had been in both bands a long time, Rat and Dokken.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you have a commitment and sort of your time becomes an investment, right? You know?
Sure.
And we had a record deal in Dokken and Rat did not have a record deal. We had done an EP, but there was no record deal guaranteed. And of course that was the big, you know, the big brass ring that everyone was trying to grab because that meant that you could sort of do what so many others had done, including Van Halen. You know, so it became really difficult because it wasn't a simple answer. But the best way I can put it is after a lot of soul searching, after a lot of speculating and just trying to sort of extrapolate what might occur, I decided that I was a better fit. I was more at home with Rat. If that makes any sense, you know, anytime you have a band, all bands require a unique set of skill sets. So the dynamics within the band will require you to act and perform and contribute in a unique way for that band. So I just felt that overall Rat was a better fit for me stylistically as a musician. Live and the way we got along was also positive. So a lot of factors went into it. And as you can clearly hear, it wasn't a simple decision.
it's crazy because these days people do it a lot. There's a lot of people. I mean, Reb Beach is in Whitesnake and Winger and, you know, does it. But back then it was like that was almost unheard of because of the record deals, you know, the music business was so demanding and the time was so demanding, but you were able to do that for 18 months. Was it just like an internal thing? Like, I got to make a decision, or was there like a pressure, like make a decision, Juan, which way are we going here? Or was it like you deciding?
I definitely decided. Look, what happened was in Dokken, we had a management team of Cliff Bernstein and Peter Minch. And if those names sound familiar, it's because they manage Metallica. So they managed Dokken back in the day and they were excellent managers, really, really clever and visionaries. And so we really had a situation that there was sort of a, like, I'd be giving up something that I sort of, you know, gave a lot of time to on something that maybe wasn't guaranteed to happen, you know. There wasn't a specific moment.
Right.
But there were a lot of sort of clues. For example, I did the EP and then management said, okay, you know, you have to sort of leave the group after that because people are starting to think that you're in that band and not in Dokken. Well, the situation at the time was that Dokken wasn't playing live. So, you know, I just wanted to play some shows and make a little bit of extra money, because the truth is that I was a starving musician. And back then, a lot of musicians did, they network, you know, there wasn't like the internet and phones and things, you know, cell phones. You had to do a lot of legwork, and you had to show up in person and, you know, see what band was doing what. And, you know, so it required a lot of effort to stay alive, you know, and with hopes of succeeding someday. And so when I did go ahead and make the decision, it was really based on what I thought had the most potential for my skill set. And one of the turning points for me was when I believe it was Robin and Steven came over, when the EP was finally finished and pressed, right? So we recorded the EP. I had to leave the group, didn't see him for a while. They finally come over with the finished product. I put it on my turntable and I set down the needle on the vinyl. And I just, and it was like, wow, this is really good. Oh. It was raw. It was nasty. It was in your face. You know, it was just everything that I was hoping it would be.
Yeah.
You know, so that started making it, you know, that started kind of making it easier for me to make that decision. You know, so, you know, these, you know, you always try. Well, back then, we're talking such a long time ago, you know, it really, for a lot of folks, you know, it was do or die. It was work a day job or make it in a rock band, or work a day job, go to college, get your degree, and work in a rock band.
Ooh, too many steps there.
You know, so that was sort of the dilemma for several. And of course there was the ever popular, you know, make it in a band or sleep on your friend's couch, right? You know, so, that was sort of one of the components of it.
Absolutely. Oh, that great answer there. And thanks for the question, Shaggy Shane. He always, he's a little older than me, so he's in tune with that era like nobody I know. So thank you, Shaggy Shane. Before we let you go, Juan, and you've been so gracious with your time and it's been so great to catch up, I want to make sure everybody, knows the Rat Atlantic Years box set 84 to 91. It's a limited edition and it is out through BMG in partnership with Rhino Entertainment. Before we let you go, Juan, we got our final four drum roll, which is four quick questions. We'll have some fun. Give us whatever comes to mind.
All right.
Okay. People always say Rat, you know, that what was missing, why didn't Rat become, you know, Motley Crue, Galactic, you know, was it the ballad? Was Giving Yourself Away, should that have been the ballad that went over the top for Rat?
You know, again, it's hard for me to speculate because it's so subjective, right? So that was a song that that had a participation from Diane Warren and Desmond Child. And, you know, I mean, you know, they're superlative writers. They're amazing. So it a lot of times it's timing,
sure,
and it's how the song is performed. So, you know, in music, when you're making a song, and I'm sorry, I'll make it quick.
No, that's cool. It's good.
You not only have to, you know, perform it and sing it, but you sort of have to get it across to where the listener can really relate to it. Okay. And so there's a lot of factors. I don't know if that would have made a difference. And certainly Giving Yourself Away is an excellent, is a very well-written song. Let's just say that.
I love it. You know? Love that song. It's still a go-to. Okay. So in LA in the Sunset Strip, Motley Crue, kind of had, their home base. They played everywhere. You guys all played all the clubs. Motley Crue, probably best known for the Whiskey. What would you say Rat's home club was? Was it the Whiskey? Was it the Troubadour? Did you have one that you preferred?
When it comes to Rat, most of my memories, and there are numerous, but the one club I tend to gravitate to would be the Troubadour.
Sure. Great.
Yeah. There was a time that, you know, we were playing and there weren't that many folks showing up. And I remember one time I was pulling up in my truck and, we're like looking at me and the drummer, and we're looking and we're going, hey, there's a line of people. Oh, it must be that restaurant next door to the Troubadour. And then as we're getting close, we're going, no, it looks like it's a line for the Troubadour. Looks like there's a line to see us.
See us. I love it.
We were shocked, you know?
Oh, I love that. Well, Zoom's going to cut us off in 2 minutes. We got to go quick. What is the first concert you ever attended in the States, in America?
It would be my brother's band, The Symbols of Time, back when I was about 5 or 6 years old in Torrance, California. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. What was the first album you bought with your own money or that you stole, either one?
It was the single called Take It Easy for the Eagles.
Well, that is you say that almost like that was like an obscure song or something. That's just kind of, you're like, no, there's a song called Take It Easy. I just saw Travis Tritt perform that.
That's funny. I was only thinking, did I buy the single first?
Right.
Or did I buy the album? And sure. I remember me and a friend of mine went to Sears. Okay. Back when it was a buy all, whatever you want store. And he bought Bill Withers' Lean On Me. And I bought Take It Easy by the Eagles.
Awesome.
And went home and put it on. And it just changed my life.
I love that. I love that story. One, you've been so gracious, and I thank you so much for coming back on. I always appreciate you are always so responsive and to be able to get a hold of you. And I'm just like, you know, one, I really want to talk about this box set, and I wanted to do it with you because it's been so long, and the box set hadn't come out when I talked to Steven last. So thank you so much for doing this, and best of continued success. Best of luck continued being a dad and doing all the family stuff. You're a true great one, man. You're just a good guy, and I appreciate you.
Well, thank you, Clint. It's been a pleasure. It's great to be back. Good luck on your show, and if there's anything you need, you know, always feel free to reach out. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Juan. Take it easy, and we'll catch up soon, my friend.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.